This is the GameIndustry.biz microcast on March the 4th, 2024. I'm James Batchelor, Editor-in-Chief of GameIndustry.biz. I'm joined this week by, as always, Christopher Dring, Head of GameIndustry.biz, and we have a special guest, Thomas Puhart from Remedy Entertainment, Communications Director of Remedy Entertainment, I believe.
Correct. Thank you.
Good. Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us, Thomas. Really, really do appreciate you joining us on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, and don't thank me yet. I haven't said anything interesting yet, so let's see where we end up. But nice to be here.
You're going to be helping us dive into the biggest news of the past week. But first, kind of congratulations, because one of the big news stories of the last week is that Remedy has acquired the rights back to Control. So the Control IP, and then obviously the multiplayer spin-off and the sequel is now fully going to be handled by Remedy. That's fantastic news.
Well, thank you. We always own the IP. So this was more about publishing rights, which is always complicated thing. A lot of things are tied into that. But now we have it. All 505 is handling the first Control until the end of the year, and then now we're kind of evaluating like how we're gonna bring these games to the market. As I think we said in the press release. So I mean, obviously this isn't like a sudden thing. This has kind of been in the works for a while, but it's pretty unprecedented that we're in the situation where both Alan Wake and Control in pretty much every way are ours, so we get to decide as a company what we're going to do with those. So hopefully we decide well.
I've already seen plenty of people asking for you to take back Quantum Break as well, and personally, as a fan of that game, yes, I'd like to see more Quantum Break.
It's funny that people bring that up now, because when it came out, you know, there wasn't that, it did okay, but there wasn't a lot of excitement around that. I mean, people had a hard time accepting the fact that, like, kind of half the experience is watching live action. I'm not a huge fan of the amount of live action in our games, but, like, I mean, who else has tried to make a game like that? But there's all this, you know, Windows Store back then, we launched there, that wasn't exactly great. So there was kind of lots of different things happening back in February, April 2016 when Quantum Break came up. But like a lot of people have come around since, like, oh, that game is actually like great. I'm like, yeah, you know, there's like fantastic story in it. The action's pretty solid. So it's got its problems for sure. But it's been interesting to see how people have come around to that. But there's a good lesson also, which kind of ties probably into the rest of the discussion, how like that day one or even the first couple of months for a game are just really the beginning of the journey. That's just so different than what it used to be.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Well, is it, and we'll come back to Alan Wake, I guess, but is it a quieter year for you now that you've, because last year, Thomas, I saw so much of you at, you know, Gamescom and Summer Games Fest and EGX and, with the big Alan Wake campaign, which it's interesting because we ran a piece recently for Mortals of Avium and they were talking about how hard it was to get awareness in a year where there were so many massive, massive titles out. But I think Alan Wake managed it. So and obviously a very nice thing. Obviously, that's, I'm praising you there. But the it must have been exhausting. So are you looking forward to a quieter 24?
Well, thank you. I mean, 23 was stressful, but I mean, a lot of fun. I mean, you know, it's Alan Wake 2. So as always, we had all this sort of pent up things that we wanted to do, that Sam wanted to do, that have been, you know, waiting for like almost like a decade. And like with Epic, we pretty much got to do everything we wanted. You know, we got to do a nice big event, we got to do Gamescom and everything. And so it was a lot of fun. And I mean, I'm a workaholic, so I like it. Definitely need a break. And it's just interesting where even like looking at 24, you know, we have DLC for Wake to work on. It feels like we're a big enough company that there's always like something. Yeah. Like I'm being told like, oh, you should, you know, take your time off, you know, some overtime accumulated and vacations that I haven't used, and that goes for other people as well. And there's always like, every week starts with like, I'm gonna like do some long-term planning, which I'm poor at because boring. Always something comes up, like, you know, all of these Control 505 things and then results and whatnot. While I'm not kind of in the center of all of that, there's always something that comes up, and now it's like already like March. GDC is in 2 weeks.
You're going out to GDC.
Looks like it. And then there, we have like 10 talks on Alan Wake 2, so I'm like, I'm going to kind of have to go look after people there and a bunch of meetings. But then it's April, and it's just...
We're halfway through the year all of a sudden,
And the thing is, like, we have so many projects, which is good, but then if you take like an extended period of time off, then suddenly you're kind of like behind. I'm already behind. Like I've just been in Alan Wake 2 land for like 2 years, while other people kind of in the team have slowly started looking into the other stuff. But it's good to be busy, and it's good that there's work, especially when looking at all the things that are going on in the industry. So can't complain.
Well, on that note, I'd like to bring up our first story that we're going to be talking about this week is more layoffs, unfortunately. There were two big ones last week. EA is laying off 670 people, around 670 people, 5% of its workforce. It's closed Ridgeline Games, which is the Battlefield studio that it started with co-creator Marcus Leto, who had already left the studio. It's reportedly cancelled a bunch of games. Respawn's first-person Star Wars game is rumoured to be the Mandalorian game. That's been cancelled. That kind of ties in with something that EA's CEO Andrew Wilson was talking about. He was saying that the company is moving away from development of future licensed IP that we do not believe will be successful in our changing industry. They have since clarified that Black Panther and Iron Man are still in the works, but it sounds like they're not going to be as reliant on IP. Sony, meanwhile, has cut 900 workers, 8% of its workforce. It's closed PlayStation London studios. Some of the studios also affected are Insomniac Games, Guerrilla Games, Fire Sprite, Naughty Dog, and it's seemed to be stepping slightly back from the live service strategy it had. Some of the unannounced games have been canned. We don't know which ones. Rumour is the Horizon one is still in the works. Reportedly a Twisted Metal game, whether or not that was a live service, like, you know, reportedly there was a Twisted Metal game in the works. That's been removed. I mean, unfortunately, this has become almost par for the course in terms of, like, you know, it's another week, another bunch of layoffs, but these are two big ones and two big changes of strategy.
Yeah, we also had some, I mentioned before, we haven't had many studio closures. We've had a lot of talk of people cutting back, but here we are, we've got two. And one of them in London studio is like an iconic studio, and obviously SingStar and iToy and The Getaway, and it's just so many moments throughout history. And it's interesting, actually, both companies are talking, I felt it, you know, Sony's sort of moving away from live service. They've still got a load of them in the works. They've just released Helldivers 2, for instance. So they are obviously still investing in it, but they are clearly aware of how challenging that market is now. And they are, you know, correcting accordingly, which is terrible. But then you've also got what EA's got talking about licensed IP. And I have to assume that because of the margins on games these days and how difficult people are, and how tight things have become, how costs have keep rising, that a game where you end up giving some of your revenue or whatever to a licensed partner is perhaps not as appealing as, say, it was never as appealing as a Battlefield or something, or building your own IP, but it's perhaps less justifiable. And then, you know, they're not bankable. You know, sometimes you get a big licensed game hit, but then you have something like Suicide Squad, for instance, or something like that, where it's not guaranteed. But yeah, it's really sad news. And you know, I really feel for that London studio team. Best Place to Work Awards winners, lots of rave, lots of happy staff there, and I know they're very excited about the project they're working on. Terrible.
Yeah, it's hard to even know like where to start, because it's such a large topic to conversate. And obviously, really sorry for everybody who's lost their job. And I remember when Sony shut down, you know, Liverpool, which was, you know, Psygnosis originally and all that, and I was already like but that splintered off to a bunch of other good studios, but well, including I think Fire Sprite. But it's like we have these every once in a while in the industry, like, you know, it's not like the first time that studios get shut down, costs are being cut, and we kind of reset, but the scale now is just pretty massive. But then again, the scale of games, especially like AAA, has just gotten really crazy. And it's like when people are kind of surprised, like, why is something that's kind of halfway through production cancelled. Like, isn't it like, doesn't it make sense to publish? I'm like, no, it doesn't, because like, it's probably like another 100 or 50 million investment just to get the game done. Then do the marketing. And at that point, you're probably like looking at like, okay, it's just like not worth to bring this to the market. And then what happens is, what are we going to do with these hundreds of people we have on the project? Like, this is a thing that like, and I feel for all these people, but like, where do you put them? Where do you suddenly like, oh, like we have 100 extra people, like, I'm sure the Game X budget can handle it. Like, no, like that's the crazy thing where it's just like, you can't just like shuffle people easily around. And it's, I mean, it's super harsh, and like that there's a lot of sort of blame going around, but like, you can also look at it from a point of view like, well, what if some company would go through with this one game that they're unsure of, they put it out, and then it bombs, then the whole company is at risk, even more people are laid off.
I had an investor talk to us about it before, and I didn't actually use it in the article I wrote about investment, but he made a point of saying like, you know, it sounds really horrible, but you sort of need to think about the other, you know, if you're Microsoft and you've got 22,000 employees, lay off 2,000, they're thinking, you know, I'm sure they're also thinking about their bottom line and pleasing shareholders and all the things that, there's an element of like, you know, you sort of cut early so you don't have to cut deeper later on. And, you know, because you can hire people back if you need to, but you can't get that money back. And so it's quite, you know, it's quite cold, calculating conversations. But yeah, it's, you know, if you go through with it and you end up losing more money, and then you end up having, you might be in a far worse situation. If you can hire people back, but if you run out of money, you're in trouble. And that's the sort of brutality of it, I guess. And I think the big problem is that there's no jobs for people to go to, right? That's the real thing that I find really the worst thing about this, is there's going to be a lot of people that are just going to have to leave the games industry as a result of this, because there aren't roles for them. And that is, you know, heartbreaking, I guess. It's a big topic, and we've been talking about it a lot on these podcasts. Everyone has their own individual issues, right? There's all the macroeconomic conditions. There's the fact that video games costs are going up. And so that's, you know, EA, that issue might be licensed games. For Sony, that issue is live service games and whatever. Everyone's got this slightly different variation of the issues they face. But you touched about something there, Thomas, which was that I find is that games take 5 years to make now. And when you start working on a project, you might think, right, everyone's, you know, when you started making a project in 2020, everyone was in live service worlds and online worlds and trying loads of things. You think, right, this is the future. Let's invest in this. This is where we think the money is. And then 3 years later, it turns out that market's super saturated and really challenging. And then you have to recalibrate your thinking. And that, you know, it was always a thing where games, you know, when you start working on a game, when a game comes out, the market's changed. But it's you know, even things like Suicide Squad, like when that game started entering development, like all those looter shooter things was all the rage. You know, it's and now it's come out and everyone's like, no, we've moved on, thanks. And it's really hard, isn't it?
Well, we talk a lot about it here, that like trying to like chase trends. I mean, hey, we worked on a free-to-play game that we then ended up ending in Vanguard, but we had a very small team on it. But like, if, like you said, it takes so long to make these games, like basically half a decade. And like, if you start kind of chasing trends, then like things change so fast. I always tell people here, just let's just worry about making the best game we can. And like everything else will kind of, you know, have a better chance of working out. But like, it's completely understandable that live service is still interesting, because like, if people struggle paying, you know, 80 euros for a game, then we have to find ways how we can kind of like monetize. And yes, we all know that like the market is saturated and highly competitive, and people only have so much time and money to spend, that it is just like super difficult. And I think if you look at like how long now the development cycles are, I mean, that's the reason why you're seeing a lot of these remasters. I think especially when I look at some of the Sony studios that, you know, they usually shipped in every couple of years. Now it's like 5 years, 6 years. You have to have something to make money during that time. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the Remedy is trying to do is like build that portfolio. You know, Control is still, you know, selling some units out there. And like, we try to ship something every year, whether it's a game or DLC or something. So like, the times of just working on a game for like really long and you have nothing out there on the market to make money seems like pretty impossible. And I love how, or don't love it, how people talk about, oh, they had break even, they're fine. I'm like, break even is like the laws of business is probably you should be at least like doubling, tripling what you're making, because like people seem to forget that then, you know, you have to make money for the studio and the developer to be able to make the next game and keep the lights on, not to mention the publisher needs to make money because they have another 1,000 people who rely on that game. So it's just like the scale has become so massive. Like we talked to a lot of studios, so we know, and it's not like, I mean, Remedy's changed its strategy back in 2015, 2016 to kind of, either you get bought by somebody or then you start working on a bunch of multiple games that you kind of try to split the risk. I'm oversimplifying, but like that's kind of how we ended up approaching it. It's like, let's just work on multiple games and try to ship something, if not every year, then at least a DLC or something. So, but it's just become like, you look at the costs and like people always, in some ways, I think there's quite a lot of information out there. Then people think there isn't. I'm not sure which one is right, but like looking at some of these big games where the cost is just the development cost is in like the $200-300 million range. And then the audience you're selling to, especially on consoles, there's a clear ceiling. I mean, there's what, 50 million PS5s?
Yeah.
A lot less Xboxes, and Game Pass is kind of making consumers maybe not buy games. So ultimately it's like the thing is, how can you complain about prices of games going up when the cost of making games is like ridiculously higher than it was even 10 years ago, and yet the audience we're selling to hasn't really grown? So it's just, I think a lot of these things are kind of coming to head now.
Yeah, well, it's interesting actually, because I played Turok 3 at the weekend, which is, you know, a remaster of that game, and that game is 6 hours long, which I didn't know. I remembered it being much, much longer. And that game cost me £50, I think, in 2000, which I think is about £85 today. So I'm sitting there going, video games have got longer, more complex, deeper, and cheaper. That's the real journey of these games. And of course, people are, you know, value is a perception thing. But in like real terms, and when the games industry is growing and got different revenue streams and different monetization streams, then it's sort of fine. But when we get to the point now where there is a ceiling, when the audience isn't growing necessarily, and you've sort of tapped out all your DLC and microtransaction options, and consumers are saying they don't accept any more price increases, you've got what we're seeing at the moment, and it's certainly a difficult time. But you know, it's like interesting because Remedy's, I might be wrong, Thomas, this might be an old conversation, but I remember Remedy sort of very much is like, how do we make incredible, because Alan Wake 2 is it looks AAA, right? It feels AAA. You know, I don't think there's anyone's doubt in anyone's mind it's AAA. But I imagine it, I'm not sure what the budget is, but I imagine like you think you want 1.3 million sales you've announced. That seems, and the fact you announced it suggests to me you're happy with it, right? And yet there's other games out there that have done double that, triple that, and have been disappointed in those results. And I think people are probably tapping on your shoulder saying, how did you do it? How do you make these games look that good and not, you know, spend $300 million on it?
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, Alan Wake 2 wasn't, I mean, there's a significant budget attached to the game, but like compared to anything that first parties, shouldn't even compare to first parties, but like even other third parties that they spend, like the budget is still pretty sensible. And we of course always like try to do that. Like I said, the fact that we have multiple games like lessens the risk that if one game doesn't do massively well, you know, we're not in trouble. But like I don't exactly know how it's just blood, sweat and tears really how we end up making these games, and somehow we were able to get it together. But like, you know, we talk about the complexity of making these games all the time, and like how to kind of keep the budgets sensible, but I look at, like, we've been around, I think maybe next year, in 2 years, it's Remedy's like 30th year. And for like an independent company to survive in this industry for that long is just incredible. And you don't do that unless, well, you need luck, you need good games, but you need pretty damn good, you know, business management skills and relationships and all those. And somehow we've been able to kind of navigate all that. But it's not like, you know, it's what's happening now isn't really a massive surprise. Like, costs are just like massively high. People spend more time on online games, maybe buy less games. I mean, you go back to like PlayStation 1, we all played a bunch of different games. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you could, even millions might have bought something like Parappa or like Vibribbon, or, well, millions didn't buy that one, but, like, you know, like, it was just like people just played a lot more different games because it didn't take so damn long. So, like, I feel like it just isn't, like we discussed, the cost of making games are gone up, but there's a clear sort of install user base that you have to try to sell.
And their time is being spent up because their games are so big. But it's interesting, actually, because in the piece we did with, on the site last week, we did an interview with Ascendant Studios, Immortals of Avian, which was a flop last year, and Brett Robbins talked about how actually sales improved when there weren't as many big blockbusters that came out. So they've actually seen most of their sales in the last like 3 months. And it's interesting because I don't know, I looked at, I know you released the Alan Wake figure, Thomas, and I don't know how much you can even talk about this because it's, yes, you're in your, that game got to 1 million by the end of the year. And then you've done like 300,000 in just like the first month of the year, which suggests, I'm putting two and two together and I'm saying, well, maybe when things have got a bit quieter, and maybe it's gone on sale or whatever. I don't know if that it has. I think it has. And that suddenly gives a great opportunity for people that saw it win all these awards and saw the rave reviews, but didn't have to because they were busy with Assassin's Creed or Spider-Man or whatever at the time, or Starfield. They go, well, now I can pick this up, and it sort of is that. I don't know if that's something you've seen or if that's something.
Yeah, I read the interview, the article you did. I think it was Brett, right?
Yeah.
And like when I looked at them, not nothing but respect to him and to that studio, but when I looked at them, their studio, like, oh, they're shipping like original IP, and is that like, I don't know, but I was like, man, that's a single game. Are they just betting on that game doing really well to keep the studio going? I'm like, that's very risky. It's just like selling new IP, it's like no matter what time of the year it is like super difficult, and it's easy to kind of look at like, oh, EA's got the machinery to do it. Like, no, it's not that easy. It's like really, really challenging. And to me, like games used them, you can go back like a decade almost or something, where like the first 2 weeks were pretty much like 90% of your sales. Like that was the thing.
It'll be in pre-owned, just, won't be in the pre-owned bins, and you can't, it's gone then, isn't it?
Yeah. And like what we looked at, I mean, sure, like always having a great start is obviously great. Like as pot sales as we can just get, like as soon as we can, the better, obviously. But things have just changed a lot. And like, I mean, we had our best selling month on Control, I think something like 2.5 years, 2 years or something after launch. And that wasn't just because it was cheaper. I mean, yes, the price dropped, but like it's, like you said, like people just have a lot of games to play. And I think now it's more like, instead of immediately getting a game, oh, that's a great game. And obviously the more awards and the more prestige, everything you get, the more you kind of plant the seed of like, oh, I'm going to get that when the time is right. Now, if the time is right, when there's a discount or something, probably. So, I mean, we've always looked at, I mean, we kept selling Control for several years, and we've always looked at Alan Wake 2 as well, that like, oh, it's like, you know, 24 is all about selling more copies of Alan Wake as is 25. That doesn't mean we don't want like a great launch, but then people also confuse units sold is a whole different thing than revenue. And as long as you can keep the price up of the game, that it doesn't go down too much, then that's where you want to be. And there's a lot of examples on that, like when we look at like Sony first party, they're able to keep the price points pretty high for a pretty long period of time. And that to me is really, really important. So it's not, a surprise that they're seeing sales like 6 months after launch. And there's always this like, oh, you launched at the like wrong time. I'm like, it's just at some point you have to launch.
Yeah.
Like you never know what's going to land on your date. And we moved Alan Wake's to date by 10 days because of Spider-Man. We're like, okay, like we won't even get visibility in like the storefronts during those days. And media is only going to talk about it. Understandably so. So that made sense. But like we absolutely wanted to come out in October, make sure we kind of hit the Halloween, and we make sure that December, when you know consumer spending habits are up, people want to be buying games. We knew we had a good game coming out. There's the award season, so all of these things matter. I mean, when I was a journalist, we're always like, when we're choosing games of the year, we're like, what came out in the spring, beginning of the year? Nobody remembered. And you would go through the magazines, like, oh yeah, that game came out. So it's like you want to come out in the fall, but obviously, you know, we know all about bad dates when original Alan Wake came out with Red Dead Redemption.
You just said there's like what Brett said in the interview, which is like, you know, we could have perhaps launched the game in February 2024, and said, but then Helldivers 2 would have eaten our lunch. And it's like, you just don't know, you know, it's a good window. You know, I think a lot of people thought August was an okay window. They didn't expect Baldur's Gate 3 to just go. So, you know, it's you never know. And that's the thing, like, you know, we could move it, but then, you know, we're not necessarily moving to anything better.
No, and like, it's hard to even explain, like, once the wheels are in motion. Like, you're not just like spending so much kind of your mental capital that, oh, there's a date like we can all work towards doing. And you all, after 4 years, you really want the game out, right? Like, it's been long enough. It's not necessarily like we want to even spend, because we could spend infinite amount of time on these games. So at some point you have to get it out. And so much is already lined up from whether it's like publisher support and partners and this expecting you to come out. And there's like hundreds of things being lined up, so like moving the dates is difficult because of that. And like you said, you never know what's going to come out. Like some companies can afford to just like, oh, we're going to launch like in 2 months. You're like, oh fuck, like that's going to come out now.
Well, I guess where are the time, James? Should we move on to the final story?
Kind of want to bring up the other story as well. Like, so the other big story last week, what I thought was quite interesting, was Rockstar is reportedly shifting back to 5-day weeks in the office. So this comes from Bloomberg. Bloomberg sources kind of passed on an internal email from head of publishing Jen Colby, which said, that they're mandating that people need to come back into the office and work 5 days a week without doing hybrid. They claimed that the email claims that the new policy is for productivity and security reasons, adding that Rockstar sees tangible benefits of everyone working in an office. This is kind of a conversation that's been brewing slowly since kind of the end of the lockdowns a good few years ago. Rockstar's not the only people who've started kind of mandating people come back into the office. Activision Blizzard mandated that people do 3 days a week in the office. Roblox did 3 days. Ubisoft Montreal mandated 2 days in the week. I suspect there are a fair number of managers that would like to see people come back to 5 days, but equally the workforce has really become accustomed to hybrid working or even fully remote working. Thomas, like, I'm intrigued to see your thoughts on remote working versus hybrid working, etc.
I have a lot of opinions on this, so like I can understand Rockstar very well. They ain't the only ones. Like, I can understand it very well. Like, look, I'm finished, so I'm like blunt, and I'm like, if you work for somebody, they call the shots, they tell you got to work 5 days in the office. To me, in some ways, it's quite simple. Unless like other things have been promised. I can Remedy operates in a hybrid model, so we kind of hope that people average out like 3 days in the office, but really it's like teams, you can decide how you want to work, but it's important to like actually meet face to face. And I think like again, it's a larger conversation, because like I think in some parts of like UK and especially in the US, it's like the quality of like this remote working just was a bigger thing there, where you're sitting in traffic for hours, and where there's a culture of like, oh, you gotta kind of, it's not an 8-hour working day, it's actually 10 hours because you have to kind of be there, and these sorts of like unhealthy things. Where I'm in Finland, at least maybe I've been lucky, I've always worked at companies, even at Remedy, where even pre-pandemic, it's like, okay, like we've been, you know, working pretty hard. I'm just going to take like Monday or Friday off. And like, that's the conversation. Like, yeah, you should just stay home. That's fine. Like, it's not like, that's it. Like I often said, like common sense works. But in 23, like I was here like every day, like not most weekends, but like I'm voluntarily because I like working, but like I would, even on Saturday, I'd much rather come to work in the office, and I live by myself, so I don't have any distractions except Destiny 2 at home. but I would just want that separation where like, I'm just going to go work for hours in the office, and then I'm in that mode anyway. So I mean, we ship plenty of stuff like completely remote, like PS5, Series X and S version of Control Ultimate Edition was height of the pandemic. We shipped that remotely, but granted it's more of like a port work and that sort of thing. But like on Wake, like most of our marketing team and comms team all sits in the same room, and we were all, like most of the people were in the office like every day. And like when you get to that shipping phase, like we had the QA room next to us. And for me as a person who kind of also owned player experience and Alan Wake, it's like I need to be seeing like the builds and all the different machines. Like I need to be able to walk in a room instead of at home always like downloading like another 50 gigs and things like that. So from like an efficiency standpoint, like I couldn't, and most of the leads were all in the office on Wake, and this wasn't like a mandated thing. It's just what people gravitated to. It's just like, as much as it's annoying that you try to concentrate and somebody taps you on the shoulder, like, hey, what about this thing? That's just how it is when it's so complex. Like we didn't have most of the people have time to like wait 3 hours for somebody to get back to you on Slack. Now you can say that, well, it works for other companies. Every company is different. Every culture is different. Like all the teams even here are like different. Like the Control 2 dev team is set up way differently to like the Alan Wake 2 dev team. The personalities are different and so on. But like I can understand why companies want employees back in the office. I mean, like I said, I was in the office every day in 23, and now in 24, I'm trying to be as much as out of the office as I can, because I can make it easier. And that's like, I like my free time, but I can see like the benefits. But like, it's incredible to me that like Insomniac, I think, mostly operates remotely, and like they put out incredible games. So it's not like you can't.
I find it depends. Studios operate differently, right? And some you know, really struggled with the move to remote or hybrid working, and some sort of embraced it and it's worked for them. And it depends on the people, it depends on the project, depends on the, you know, it depends on so many things. That's what I find. And obviously Rockstar have that other element where they're basically working on the biggest entertainment launch we'll ever see, right? They're looking this is going to be massive, massive, massive. And already the PR plan hasn't gone to plan because of all these leaks and all these things. You know, having that control as well is important. I think the challenge, I think, is that for so long now people have been used to hybrid working. And you think about the cost of living crisis. And if you've got kids, you know, the cost that you have to pay on nursery fees, and if you're not able to pick them up on time from school, that quality of life thing, you know, the cost of travel and the cost of commuting. Of course, it's different if you live next door to the office and you are, you know, maybe you don't have those sort of dependencies and stuff. It's different, and that is the challenge. That's the hard thing. And I think the real hard thing is that we're talking about the layoffs just earlier. The employees for a long time had an awful lot of power when there was this war for talent and everyone was fighting over all the limited senior people out there. You know, everyone was going, okay, we're going 4-day working weeks and we're going to increase salaries, increase benefits, and remote working and hybrid working. Basically, we just want you to join us. Please join us. We'll offer you whatever you want. And now the situation's reversed. You know, the employees ultimately, if they could sit there and get annoyed and walk out of Rockstar, but actually, where do they go? And it's the power that's shifting. And obviously, you just hope people aren't being, you know, dicks about it, basically. And it's really difficult. You know, depending on the person, it might be really costly. You know, I'm actually somebody that actually really values being in an office with people. But at the same time, if I was asked to go into the office every day, I'd be like, oh, but that would be less time with my boys, and that would be I guess Rockstar's gonna have to manage that those conversations and hopefully do what they can but I understand why they would want to do it, particularly this close to the launch of what will be the biggest entertainment launch in history.
Yeah, and there's no, like, you know, every, like I said, every company is different and employees are different and locations are, you know, different. Like the commute here in Helsinki, like my commute's like 25 minutes or 30 minutes, and by Helsinki standards, it's actually surprisingly long on public transport. So I totally feel for like people in like LA or London where like if I would have to sit in the car for 90 minutes one way while I worked on Alan Wake 2, that would have just been terrible.
Yeah.
That's just absolutely terrible. So I get it. But it's, you're in these weird situations where like these big companies obviously have big, nice offices and like they're paying for them because like often the lease has to be done for like, I don't know, like 5 years. So it's like insane empty offices that you can't even get out of like the deal of having them. So there's also that, like, maybe people should be here, but I think ultimately what matters is like, how can you ship games and not like work people to, you know, to death, and like how can you make it the process as smooth as possible. I mean, that should be the main thing, but like I think for a very long time it worked that people are in the same physical space for at least a couple of days. And I don't think that's gone away, but it's such a like role specific thing. There are several, like there's a couple of people at Remedy who are fully remote and they do a very specific thing. So like they don't necessarily every fucking day have to be talking with somebody to get the lay of the land, so to speak. So it's challenging. At least I like the way we do it, that it's this kind of hybrid where in the office sometimes away, and it's like it's sensible.
I'm interested to see who goes next. Rockstar, as far as I can tell, is the first one that's gone back to the full 5 day week. I'm intrigued to see if other companies kind of use this as not an excuse, but kind of a jumping off point. It's like, well, we're not the first movers now. Like, you know, we would like you back in 5 days a week, or even pushing up to 4 days a week or something. Like, you know, I'm intrigued to see how this evolves over the next year or so as people push towards getting, you know, certainly managers of certain companies push towards getting people back into the office.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, like I said, companies are different. So I know some are already mandating it, and maybe with pretty much the same reasoning. So it's everybody operates in somewhat different ways.
I think we're going to wrap it there because we are definitely beyond micro for this. Definitely into megacast territory. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us for our first megacast.
Yeah. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
No, it's really, really appreciated time. Hopefully have you back on another week, and hoping your 2024 is a bit quieter as we originally hoped.
So. I don't think it will be, but let's see.
Well, best of luck with GDC. Thank you, dear listener or viewer, for sticking with us for the entire episode. If you want to check out previous microcasts, they're on the podcasting platform of your choice or on the GamesIndustry.biz YouTube channel. We are going to be back next Monday with the next microcast, and you can find more news, insight and analysis into the world behind video games at GamesIndustry.biz.